from WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington. Welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Jack Wilson. He is the chair of the Virginia Republican Party. Right now, we're joined in studio by Dion Reeder. She is a candidate for the D.C. Council at-large seat. She is an independent. Dion Reeder, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to Dion Reeder specifically, Tom, I wanted to talk about what happened in Montgomery County with independent candidate, former Democrat, like some people in the studio with us, Nancy Florine, who apparently has returned $18,000 in contributions. And Nancy Florine, like somebody else in this room, has a lot of support from the business community in Montgomery County.
Don't be conflating things.
And apparently, one of those businesses in particular had all of its contributions returned because they came from four donors, but they all apparently listed the same address, which happened to be the address of the general contractor for the troubled Silver Spring Transit Center, something that you like to talk about.
That's true. But for the listeners in the campaign finance in Maryland, Montgomery County, there are limits of $6,000 that any person can give. And these companies... If a company is owned 80% by someone and he has two or she has two companies, so they can only give one gift. And in this case, Florine, a citizen challenged Florine's contributions and said that she was getting lots of money from developer or business interests from the same people. And so there was the Board of Elections was looking at it. She also looked at it, and she has voluntarily said, well, we see potential problems with $18,000, and we're refunding the money. In Maryland, it's not the candidate's responsibility by law to keep track of the contributions. It's the individual and the company that cannot violate the law. But in this case, Florine looked at it, agreed that there were some problems, and refunded the money.
On to the District of Columbia, where we talk a great deal about our democracy and how Congress tends to trample over it, particularly the Republicans in Congress. But a lot of times, sometimes we don't pay enough attention to our own democracy in the city, as in the advisory neighborhood commissioners. And now the Democratic Socialists of America are apparently going to be running for like 11 ANC seats in the districts. And I am sure that one of their motives is to try to make sure that the ANCs are empowered in the city.
Well, the ANCs have a varying power depending on who the members are. They're unpaid. ANC commissioner represents about 2,000 people. I think there are 36 different ANC organizations across the city. And this is a smart move by the Democratic Socialists of America. It's hard to, as the Statehood Party and the Green Party and other parties have found, it's very difficult to jump into citywide or even ward-wide elections. But this is called grassroots, ground-up building. You got a few ANC commissioners. You get involved in city issues in your neighborhoods. You get to know some of the officials making decisions on transportation, development. Then you can build a political base. And that's what they plan to do. They have 11 candidates, I believe. Not all eight wards, but across the city. And this is how, if you need to build a movement, this is how you do it.
Our guest is Dion Reeder. She is a candidate for the D.C. Council at large seat. She is an independent, raised in Ward 1 in the District of Columbia, and still, it is my understanding, living in your family home in Ward 1. Have you ever considered running for ANC in Ward 1?
I lived in Ward 1 the majority of my life, but I've done the majority of my work in Ward 5 and Ward 8. And most people know that about me. So, no, I've never considered running for ANC, but I believe in empowering our ANCs, just definitely.
You are the owner of Cheers at the Big Chair, a restaurant on Martin Luther King Avenue in Southeast Washington. From looking at your resume, born and raised in the District of Columbia, living in Ward 1, but running a small business in Ward 8, where such businesses are obviously necessary, and then you decide to jump into politics. Let me start innocently. Why did you decide to jump into this race?
Jump into politics. So I actually believe I jumped into continuing the work that I've been doing as a public servant. I believe elected leaders, whether ANC or council members or our mayor, it's important for us to understand that that should be done locally, and understanding that it comes from the work that you've done and the experiences that you've had working with people. And that's what I've done. And I've seen D.C. grow, and it's been growing, and we know that. But I believe we're growing out of balance. And we are only able to truly impact communities by looking at policy. I've worked with families and individuals, and I've done this work a significant amount of time in my life. But the reality is we were seeing the same group of people run into the same issues, almost like a hamster wheel. And people need to be impacted differently. And that comes through effective policy, policy that actually will impact them on a local level, but also help them be motivated to move beyond some of the circumstances that they're already dealing with.
You got into the campaign last summer, 2017, right?
I did.
Early on, and you were struggling along there. But let's get to the hard big news, is that Mayor Bowser, the first mayor in the city's history, has decided that she wants to take out a council member, sitting council member, Alyssa Silver.
Ooh, Anita Bonds? Oh, I'm sorry.
No. And so the mayor has positively endorsed you, and mm-hmm. you had something like $2,000 to $5,000 in your campaign account. Mm-hmm. Now you have like 100 or close to, because mm-hmm. the people who support the mayor, some who don't know you, of course, are supporting you. What does it mean to you that the mayor, with her irritation with Alyssa Silverman, the city member, has decided to support you? How did you guys discuss that when she decided to support you? Because she was also, as you everyone may remember, initially, Catherine Allen was getting the mayor's support, Mayor Tony Williams' support, David Catania's support. She couldn't get on the ballot because her petitions were bad. But what did you and the mayor talk about when she said she was going to support you?
So I'm going to answer that, but I want to go back just a little bit. You started off by saying that my race started off a little rocky. Actually, it didn't.
No, I just mean in terms of financing.
Oh, well, financially,
no,
I started
hard.
Off really well. I mean, if you really look at the numbers, I actually raised quite a few thousands of dollars.
How much?
I raised, before we got the support, close to $80,000.
Okay, so
prior
you doubled
to January.
That now. Mm-hmm. Okay,
prior
good.
To January. So, and that was, again, looking at across the whole city, that was support from everyone. So
and you were
just
out
wanted
working
to make
every
that.
Day.
Yeah, every day. And I've been doing it. I actually resigned from my position, asked my wife to come in and manage the restaurant so that we would be able to run an effective race. So just wanted to bring some clarity
okay,
that's to good. That. We started struggling in the summertime. I mean, that's when we really fell in terms of, but my momentum has never changed. And one of the things the mayor said to me, I'm going to get there, Tom. I know you.
Okay.
One of the things the mayor said to me very directly when we met, so you asked how did it happen after Mrs. Allen, and I don't know if she ever came out publicly and actually endorsed anyone but me. But when she did come out, one of the things we talked about prior to the endorsement was she commended me on my race, and she commended me on not stopping, not regardless of how much resources that I had. She wanted me to move forward, and she commended me on that. And she actually offered her endorsement because of my hard work and because of what I believe she knows, like many, many of my supporters, that I'm a hardworking person and I believe in D.C. residents and moving them forward. So that's how the conversation was had. And I am very, honestly, I'm gracious and I appreciate. I mean, I am an African-American woman born and raised in this city by two loving parents. And I grew up in an environment that you respect the office of any position. I may not like the individual. I may not respect the person, but I respect the office. And fortunately, in this case, I really respect our mayor. And for her to endorse me in a major city like D.C. as a newcomer, I think that says a lot, and I would not deny that. I appreciate the support, but I am who I am, and I've been who I am for the last 20 years. My principles are the same. My integrity never stopped when people did not stay with me, and I was committed to this race and to the people of the District of Columbia, and
one
that never stopped.
One of the big issues, even before the mayor, of course, got endorsed you, when you started, your concern as a small businesswoman about paid family leave, that you support paid family leave, but you, like other businesses, are concerned that paid family leave would be a burden on your small business and other small businesses. Paid family leave passed despite the mayor's opposition to it. What would you do if you were a council member on this particular issue? And this is an Alyssa Silverman key issue.
Mm-hmm.
She supports it strongly.
Mm-hmm.
How would you change? What would you do to make paid family leave Would you just get rid of it, or would you change the taxing scheme, which taxes businesses 0.62%?
Well, I think it's a couple of things, and we're actually looking at one of. I'm glad you mentioned that. I am in support of it.
You're supportive of the concept, but not the way it's financed.
I am in support of the concept, but not the way it's financed.
So how would you change it?
Well, how would I change it? We're looking at that, Tom. I'm not going to tell you right here today I have all the answers, but I do agree that when we're looking at a law that provides 65% of the money to other jurisdictions, we have to fix that. It is the only law that we currently have that taxes one particular industry only, and that's the business community only. There's no other remedy, I think, that was ever even introduced that was that anyone paid attention to. I like some parts of what Mary Che, Councilmember Che, excuse me, what she proposed, but I'm not going to say that I agree with everything that's in that bill.
Her proposal. That's a payroll tax on individuals.
Mm-hmm. So I don't agree with everything in that.
But you're not yet for that, but you would consider that.
I would consider that. But okay. I would consider anything over 65% of the money leaving the city. And that's just the truth. I think that there's ways that we can do it that's more effective. We're looking at those ways. And I would not right now want to speak out of turn and say to you, we have the remedy to that. I'm not a council member, but one of the things, and I'm going to follow the law. I wouldn't be running if I wasn't. So right now the law is that my business has to pay 0.62% payroll taxes so that individuals can receive this benefit, and that's what we're going to do. Fortunately for me, my employees are D.C. residents.
You mentioned that 65% of that money leaves the city. Do you think the district should have responsibility for the family and medical leave for people who work in D.C. but cannot afford to live here?
No, I don't, because they're not residents here, and I think that's half of our issues. We have to be pro-D.C. residents.
What about
those are the individuals? Those are the individuals who vote. You can't vote for me if you live in Maryland, Virginia, or Pennsylvania.
By law, though, you can't. There's no by law. You can't limit it to district citizens.
No, that's what we know. That's why I can't say we only can tax that. That's right. What I'm saying. But the question was asked, should we do that? And I'm saying to you, we have to take care of D.C. residents. I am pro-D.C. resident. That's why I'm running for D.C. City Council. And if I'm pro any other jurisdiction, then maybe that's where I should run for city council.
Another big
Our guest is Dionne Reeder. She's a candidate for D.C. Council. Don?
Another major issue is the Initiative 77.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to ask you your position. That is the initiative that was passed by the voters that would raise all minimum wage salaries to $15 an hour over a period of time instead of the two-tier system we have. You, as I understand, when you talked to the Labor Council about its endorsement, said that you, even though you were opposed to Initiative 77 as a restaurant owner and thought it would hurt workers, that you did not want to overturn the will of the voters. However, since that time, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, you met with the Restaurant Association once this law repealed. And you changed your position and you supported repeal and you got the restaurant endorsement. Is that fair characterization? If not, tell me what I've missed.
Well, I think
Well, Kashini tweets in that Ms. Reeder has said in public forums that she personally opposed Initiative 77, but that she opposes repeal. However, when she testified at the council, she did not say anything about opposing repeal. How does she explain this inconsistency?
Thank you. I appreciate that. What I brought out at my testimony, and it's on record, is that this will hurt the industry. I'm going back to the same piece that we just discussed. We have to be mindful, too, with our communities. And you all know the fiber of D.C., the soul of D.C. really is around the small business community that actually supports and hires D.C. residents. That what gives us our own culture. This bill, again, will hurt that industry. We did not do our due diligence in educating our residents, and I'm saying we as a restaurant community, we did not do the advocacy necessary to make sure that people understood what this would do. And I think we tried our hardest. We didn't have as much time or as much money as the opponent. This is, again, another national agenda. This is not a local agenda. We are already held to the law. Oversight is critically important. We must understand that those of us in this industry, we already have to pay our employees up to the minimum wage. Many of us pay our employees more. Many individuals in this industry make much more than $15 an hour. That's not a race thing. That's not a sexist thing. That's not. We have to be honest about that. And we have people to testify about that. You heard me say that initially I didn't say anything about a repeal in my testimony. No, it was not true that since then I changed to get the restaurant support. That's not true.
Well, you did change, support. But not to get the restaurant support.
Yes, I did change because I understand that repeals will hurt everyone. I'm not in favor of repeals. I'm not. I believe in the democratic process.
You're now in favor of repealing Initiative 77.
What I'm saying is that particular initiative, it's going to hurt. It would have hurt and crushed and possibly put my business out of business.
Right. So you are in favor of repealing 77.
I'm in favor of I was always in favor of a change to the bill. Was in favor of that.
Right.
Yeah,
but you said this is part of a national agenda.
It is.
But the people who voted on this issue are all local residents.
And it's interesting enough that it was placed on the primary ballot. And primary ballots, there's a group of people, independents. Many independents did not know that they can go and actually vote in the primary election on that one particular referendum.
Here is Carl in Washington, D.C. Carl, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I have a question for your guest. If family leave should be limited to only people who live in the district, wouldn't that also mean that workers' compensation and unemployment compensation should be similarly limited to just D.C. residents and not to people who work here regardless of where they live?
Deanne Rita?
Yeah, so worker compensation, that's actually, again, that's not something only the employer has to pay into. So we have to be mindful of that. And what I'm saying is when it's a situation when the employer only has to pay into it, we also have to look completely at what the impact that has on the business. So workers' compensation, unemployment, that's a shared expense. That's not just the employer's expense.
What about minimum wage? The $15 minimum wage applies to every worker in the city that's covered, whether he or she lives anywhere in the suburbs.
But again, that's based on who you hire. So, you know, I am pro. I hire specifically. My aim is always to hire first D.C. residents. And I think that should be we should all be clear on that. However, if I'm hiring anyone that's not a D.C. resident, I will have to do my due diligence and follow the law. And that is paying all of my taxes, paying all of my responsibility. But I think we have to look at a couple of points. And I'm going to bring this out. Our city is not equitable. So when you're looking in certain communities, for instance, in my community where I have a restaurant, there's very low to no disposable income. So you get limited amount of resources coming to that community anyway for people to actually patronize the restaurant. So you're looking at a possible influx of another tax on an industry, on a business that may now not be able to survive. So now you're looking at more individuals being unemployed in that particular community where you already have a lot of challenges. But we don't look at those. We don't look at that when we're talking about enforcing laws or creating new laws on the books. We have to look at the whole picture. And I believe one of the reasons why I'm the best candidate in this race for this seat is because throughout my entire career, I've been a collaborator. I have not just looked at the immediate results, but I've looked at the impact on any decisions made that's going to impact us beyond just the immediate day. And that's what we're not doing.
As succinctly as possible, how do you differ with Alyssa Silverman on the significant issues that you see?
Before you get to that question, there are two incumbents against you whom you are running. Mm-hmm. It is clear to everyone who observes this race that Alyssa Silverman is the incumbent that you are running against. Why?
Because I'm an independent.
Yep, well, he means Anita Bonds.
Anita Bonds is on the ballot.
She's on the ballot, but I'm an independent, and Alyssa is an independent. I'm not a Democrat, and D.C. is a largely Democrat.
So you don't think
city.
You can knock off Anita Bonds?
Nor are you trying, right? But let's be clear, she's not trying.
There you go. Thank you, Tom.
Well, here's the email we got from Brian. I am an Alyssa Silverman supporter, but I have always really liked and respected you and your work in both Ward 1 and Ward 8. My intent was to vote for the two of you in the general election. That's why I raised this issue. My intent was to vote for the two of you in the general election. You can vote for two at-large members. But honestly, the racial dog whistles and back and forth insults between your supporters and Elissa's supporters makes me very upset. What will you do on your part to help smooth over the intense racial discourse in this campaign?
I am not pushing. Thank you, Brian. And I really thank you for your support and your vote. I just want one. One of the things that we have to be mindful of, I am not pushing a racial agenda. And I think that, you know, we have to wake up. I am an African-American candidate who's in a race. I'm also a lesbian candidate who's in a race. And I probably have been discriminated against more than anyone that I can probably imagine because of my choices in life. And some things I didn't choose. I didn't choose to be an African-American. I didn't choose to be a lesbian. But some people think I did. However, I am not pushing a racially divisive agenda. I'm not. I don't even know where that came from. And I think it's sad to say that because I'm a qualified person in this race, that now that I'm actually bringing about issues and looking at how we can collaborate and unite the city, which is what we need to be doing. You ask me, why do you think I'm different? I'm going to get to that answer. I'm different because I'm not divisive. I don't believe
that. When you say, excuse me, when you say I'm not divisive, are you saying Elissa is? That's why I asked for the distinction between the two.
I'm giving you distinctions between these two.
Because she's divisive and you're not.
Well, I don't exclude any community. And you have, when I say that.
Okay, be as clear as possible.
I'm going to be very clear. I am not intentionally excluding the business community. I'm not intentionally excluding developers. I don't intentionally exclude unions. I don't intentionally exclude churches. I believe it takes all of those factions, as well as the government, to be effective.
So and is what she I'm excluding? Is, I mean,
yes,
where does
you
she
hear her say it every time. Okay. Bad developers. Developers are bad. The bad developers. My whole thing is, how do we generate economic vibrancy across the entire city if we isolate development? There are bad people in every industry. So you ask me how we're different. That's one case. I don't think that you have to say that every person in every industry is bad. That's not how I look. I'm supportive of returning citizens. We were on a forum the other day, and Elissa said very clearly, and I hate to even do this, but she made it very clear that if an individual, and it's quoted, if an individual is supported by returning citizens, the question was asked around returning citizens specifically. She responded and said, you have to watch who supports you. And if a returning, basically, if I'm summarizing, if those are the kind of people that are supporting you, then you have to watch the person that you support. What is that saying to us? Nelson Mandela was a returning citizen. Martin Luther King was a returning citizen. That's how we differ. I don't believe that a particular group of people are bad because they made a mistake.
Okay. Well, let's be more specific here.
All right.
Because you paid former council member Harry Thomas Jr., mm-hmm. who spent over 3 years incarcerated for stealing money from programs meant for D.C. youth as a consultant. Ted Loza, the former chief of staff of now deceased council member Jim Graham, who served time for accepting illegal gifts, has also expressed support. Those are two returning citizens mm-hmm. who I personally happen to like, but who, when people see them in your campaign, simply wonder about why are these returning citizens returning to politics so quickly?
Because I'm a good candidate. I'm a qualified, good candidate. My work speaks for itself. And I am not going to turn away any voter to support me and the agenda that I'm pushing to unite this city across all eight wards. Yeah. No, that's it. I mean, I don't, I'm not going to turn away any support.
Look, now, very quickly, because this is important. Okay. On Tuesday, the D.C. Council held yet another a workshop on anti-Semitism because of all the turmoil we had last spring. Rabbis went, African-American ministers went, council members went. And once again, the issue came up about what is the anti-Semitism of Louis Farrakhan? Is Elissa Silverman being unfair to that African-American community, you know, east of the river? Where is Farrakhan fitting into this? Some of your supporters have accused her of sowing divisiveness. Her supporters have said, you have not, as fully as maybe you should, disavowed what happened this spring, which you had nothing to do with. Let's be clear. But as you know, and you worked in Ward 8 and other places for a long time, what is your view of the issues surrounding anti-Semitism and Louis Farrakhan, and even Reverend Wilson, who I've spoken with, who says he wants people to also be worried about anti-blackism. So where are you in all of this racial cauldron that is bubbling along here in the city? Where are you?
Where am I? So we said this repeatedly. I don't agree nor support any form of discrimination, bigotry. I don't agree with any of it. Any racial slurs, any racial actions, I do not agree. I was not raised that way, and that's not who I am. So let's clear the record for that. I am not going to be a part of a conversation that had absolutely nothing to do with me last spring. I'm not. I'm not going to entertain it. I'm not going to entertain anyone saying that because Louis Farrakhan or Reverend Wilson may have said some things in their past that I have to now tell them that they cannot enter, or tell Minister Farrakhan he shouldn't enter the District of Columbia. I'm not going to be a part of that.
Who said that?
I'm not. There's people that said that. I'm not going to be a part of that.
That sounds like the president saying some people.
I'm not going to be a part of that.
There are people who want to address some other issues here. Here is Rob in Arlington. Rob, your turn.
Wait, Arlington?
That's all right. He may be just working in Arlington. He may live in the district. Go ahead, Rob.
Kojo Sherwood, thanks so much for taking my call. Okay, real quick. Used to go into the district all the time for dinner, me and my friends, a bunch of us.
Okay, so you don't live here, but go ahead.
Yeah, we got so disgusted with the parking rates, especially around the old Ebbett Grill, one of our favorite places. It's, you know, nobody. We're tired of paying $5 an hour at a meter.
What are you going to do to change parking meter rates for people who come to enjoy nightlife in D.C.?
I'm not. Actually, I don't. We need revenue in the District of Columbia. I think that we all agree that sometimes you have to pay a little bit more than you want, but that's a part of enjoying the pleasures of any city that's growing. So I think that we have to factor that in as we look at the entertainment life that's in the District of Columbia. Maybe some of the reasons, one of the things we talk about is amenities across the entire city so we can have more of a walkable community or ride our bikes more like what Tom does.
Indeed, we got someone who tweeted in, what does Dion think about bus lanes, bike lanes, more transit, deprioritizing cars?
Well, I do both. I ride my bike, my wife and I have a tandem, and I drive my wonderful Mini Cooper. So one of the things I think we have to do, if you're using your bike the same way that I drive my car, we have to share the road, so we both have to be responsible.
You know, education is a huge issue in this
it
city.
Is.
There are bills in the council. One would take away the mayor's, Mary Che, who you spoke of provenly of a moment ago, has a bill that would take away the appointing power of the mayor to pick the chancellor and return that to the state school board. Where do you stand on the mayor appointing the chancellor?
Well, I've actually lived in this city under both.
So where do you stand?
So currently right now, I'm actually, I think we need to do more work around our education gap, the achievement gap, the disparities. And my focus isn't completely just on the selection of the chancellor. So, do I think that the mayor should continue to select the chancellor? At this point, I do. I haven't seen enough. I think that we also need to make sure that there is more involvement. And quite frankly, I think our independent school board, our current school board needs to have more of a voice and more power. So it should be a shared responsibility, and I believe that our mayor should listen to that group, and I believe she is. And if she isn't, she should, because I believe we have, I mean, Marcus Batcher is a young man I'm very proud of. He speaks highly of the education process, and he has a very good point in terms of how things should be moved forward. So I think we should take into consideration how we can do a better job collectively.
We're just about out of time, but the business community has rallied around you. But Tom Lindenfeld, the former top strategist for Mayor Bowser and former mayors Fenty and Williams, said the business community have, quoting here, never elected anyone in this city ever. How are people responding to your message?
Are you talking about Tom Lindenfeld, that we didn't quote anything about him?
Let's just be clear. This is an issue that has come up.
And the
city paper story quoted Tom Lindenfeld as saying just what you said there.
Yeah.
But they did not point out Tom Lindenfeld himself had a criminal issue up in Philadelphia.
Pennsylvania,
a pass-through for some money to one of the politicians up there.
Convicted.
He didn't go to prison, but he did plead guilty.
So, final question.
About the business? Tom Lindenfeld is right about the business community. It's had a hard time electing anybody.
Yep, and guess what else we're right about? This is the first time the mayor have ever endorsed a first-time candidate. So it's a different city that we're living in. So maybe this is the first time the business community has ever seen a candidate like Dion as qualified.
Now, is former Mayor Tony Williams, who was going to support you, I did the city paper story.
You got 30 seconds.
And then he didn't, and then he supported Catherine Allen. Mm-hmm. She's out. I haven't seen him yet.
I was a different candidate a year ago when the mayor saw me.
But what about right now?
Right now, I have not talked to him, but I'm almost certain I'm going to get his vote. Let's ask him.
I think we just did.
Yeah, I think I'm almost certain he's going to vote for me.
Call us, Tony. Dion Reeder is a candidate for the D.C. Council. She's in the at-large race. She's an independent. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next is Jack Wilson, who is the chair of the Virginia Republican Party. This week, Tom Sherwood, Vincent Gray, former mayor and now chair of the Council Committee on Health, had a hearing on exactly what is going to be happening with Providence Hospital. The people who run Providence Hospital, Ascension Healthcare, associated with the Catholic Church, have indicated that there are going to be significant changes at Providence Hospital, leading a lot of residents to believe that, well, they're shutting the thing down. But Ascension never did show up for this hearing, even though a lot of residents did, and Ascension has been very vague about what exactly its plans are going to be. What's going on here?
Well, part of the problem is also that there's only a limited amount the council or the city can do in terms of the laws of what they can do to make a private hospital continue to do something. It has had trouble enough getting the United Medical Center, which it controls and owns, to do anything. But this has a great fear in the community, people who depend upon Providence Hospital. The city is already planning a new Washington Hospital Center has said, look, you know, we are already burdened. Other hospitals are burdened. But I think it was a bad for Ascension not to show up at this council hearing. That was a disrespect that the hospital, whatever it's planning to do, should not have done. The nurses and the doctors and the patients are all worried. And the city, of course, is focused on building the new hospital, general-purpose hospital at the St. Elizabeth campus. But this has fear in the hearts of many people who depend upon Providence.
Before we get to Virginia politics, a little more Maryland politics. Governor Larry Hogan has a double-digit lead over his challenger, Democrat Ben Jealous, in Maryland, even though Maryland is predominantly
2-1
Democratic at this point. But what do you feel Jealous's hope has to be at this point?
Well, his hope has to be a blue wave. Five recent polls in Maryland have all shown that something like a 20-point lead for Republican Governor Hogan over Democrat Ben Jealous. He is outgunned in terms of money, 10-1. He is trying to organize and get out 1 million voters for him. The problem is he doesn't have the money to do it, and he doesn't have the advertising to do it, so he's got to depend on a strong Democratic blue wave to help him. And now, just remember, the good news for him is everyone thought he was neck and neck against Rashurn Baker in the Democratic primary. He won by 10 percentage points, which surprised virtually everyone. So maybe there's a vote there for Ben Jealous that people aren't seeing.
And in the race for attorney general in the state of Maryland, the gap between challenger Republican Craig Wolf and incumbent Democrat Brian Frosch seems to be narrowing. It is now fewer than 10 points. Back in mid-September, the difference was like 22 points. Frosch had 58% then, Wolf 26%. Now it's down to Frosch 43%, Wolf 34%. Frosch, of course, has been attacking, Wolf has been attacking Frosch, saying that he's paying too much attention to national issues. Frosch has been touting the fact that he's been paying attention to national issues and challenging the Trump
Attorney General
administration.
Is a very popular politician in the state of Maryland, but Craig Wolf could be benefiting from a bounce off of Hogan. Hogan has endorsed Craig Wolf. Craig Wolf has been a lobbyist on Capitol Hill for the wine and distilled spirits industries. He's on this show. He's very good, presents well as a candidate, says that Frosch spends too much time dealing with suits against the Trump administration and not enough on Maryland matters. Frosch says it's all Maryland matters because all of the Maryland people are affected. But his name has gotten around better thanks to Larry Hogan, so we may be seeing that bump.
Joining us now by phone is Jack Wilson. He is the chair of the Republican Party in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Jack Wilson, thank you very much for joining us. He's not joining us by phone. He's joining us from studios in Richmond. Jack Wilson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you very much.
People across the country are watching Virginia's 10th district. Let me get straight to specifics, where Democrat Jennifer Wexton is taking on Republican incumbent Representative Barbara Comstock. Most polls show Wexton with a significant lead, though the Comstock campaign released its own polling showing them closer. Do you think Comstock is having trouble rallying the support she needs to win in November?
Actually, I think she's doing exactly what she needs to do. And in fact, the Comstock poll that just came out was probably a legitimate poll as compared to the more recent Washington Post poll that was questionable statistically. But I think Barbara's internal poll, which is a legitimate poll, shows that she is energizing the Republican base. She's clearly gotten a bounce out of the Justice Kavanaugh hearings. The Republicans are now energized. And I think that given Barbara Comstock's tenacious campaigning style and hard work that she puts into that district throughout the district, she's going to prevail in November.
Mr. Wilson, this is Tom Sherwood. Thank you for joining us. Now, people don't know you. You're the new Republican Party chairman in the state of Virginia. You live in Chesterfield, and you're a land use attorney there. That's outside of Richmond. You have been a Republican. I looked you up. West Virginia University, you were the head of the College Republicans in 1982. I assume you're a Reagan Republican.
I am. President Reagan was the first president I got to vote for. It was a real honor to do that.
And you've taken over from John Whitbeck, who is on the show, and I hope you'll come actually be on the show here in the studio if you come to town.
Sure.
Mr. Whitbeck came on the show, and he did something which you've already done in some of the things I've read. You acknowledge that there are strong headwinds against Republicans in this election cycle, that it's your job not just to look at the elections for November 6th, but to start rebuilding the party. You're aware, and you've said that you recognize Corey Stewart, the Republican nominee for Senate, has had mixed support even among Republicans. But your intent is a long-term view of the Republican Party in Virginia, where you haven't won a statewide race since 2009. Did I summarize it pretty quickly?
Well, yeah, that sort of may have been more in the past. Clearly, we need to do what we need to do to reunite the party. We have some challenges within the party, and my goal is to see what we can do to focus on those principles and ideals that unite us and less focus on those that perhaps we disagree on. And I think it is a longer-term plan. We've got to work together. We've got to be unified in those core principles of a Republican Party, our Republican creed that we have in Virginia, and then elect Republicans that support those. You mentioned Corey Stewart and perhaps facing some challenges within the party. And that might have been true until the judge, now Justice Kavanaugh, hearings. I've had a number of Republicans who earlier in the summer were suggesting perhaps they weren't going to be as enthusiastic for Corey, who have now come to me and said, after seeing what the Democrats did to now Justice Kavanaugh and a glimpse of what the Democrat majority would look like if they ended up taking the House and or the Senate, that many of those Republicans who were perhaps going to sit on the sidelines for Corey are now recognizing how important that United States Senate seat is, and have said now they're going to vote for him. So people that were not putting up yard signs in August are putting them up in October. And I think that bodes well for Corey.
I think the Republicans across the country, when it comes to the Senate races, are saying the same thing, that they think the fight over Justice Kavanaugh will affect the turnout on November the 6th.
800. Go ahead, please.
No, I was going to say, I think it does. I mean, there's been some discussion about how those hearings may have energized the Democrat base as well, but I think the Democrat base has been energized for a while. I don't think they can get any more energized. And so really the benefit that we got out of that process was, one, we now have a Justice Kavanaugh, conservative justice on the Supreme Court. And the side benefit was it really energized the Republican base. And folks that were perhaps a little bit down in the dumps are now focused on what exactly a Democrat majority would look like and are saying, we're not going to stand for it. We're going to get out. We're going to work. And we're going to vote until Election Day.
Our guest is Jack Wilson, chair of the Virginia Republican Party. He joins us from the studios of Audio Image in Richmond, Virginia. Speaking of what's been affecting the Republican Party in Virginia, the midterms are seen by many as a referendum on the first 2 years of the Trump administration. That's what's been energizing Democrats around the country. And the president's presence looms in the background of many of the key races. A new campaign ad for Wexton calls Barbara Comstock Trump stock and says she votes with Trump 98% of the time. President is very popular in some parts of Virginia, unpopular in others, like Northern Virginia. How do you, as the chair of the Commonwealth's Republican Party, bridge those very divergent populations? And what kind of effect is President Trump, you think, having on down-ticket candidates?
Well, again, you're right. It probably varies from district to district. In the 9th Congressional District, for example, Southwest Virginia, the president is very, very popular. And Morgan Griffith, our candidate incumbent there, and Ben Klein in the 6th District are doing extremely well. Barbara Comstock is clearly a solid Republican, but she represents her district. She represents the issues that matter to her constituents. And so when the president proposes tax relief and tax cuts that benefit Barbara's constituents, she votes for it. If there are things that the president proposes that she doesn't believe are important or supportive of her constituents, she doesn't stand
like
with
the president. Like draining the swamp in a district in which a great number of people happen to work for the federal government?
And again, that's an example when I think the president suggested perhaps freezing federal pay raises. Barbara was not in favor of that.
You kind of throw some support for her for that.
Right. But again, I think it showed that she is sort of an independent. She's going to do what is best for the citizens and of the 10th Congressional District. And if that aligns with the president's agenda, that's exactly wonderful. But if not, she's going to stand for her constituents. And that's what she's always done. And she recognizes that she's got a very diverse district. I mean, you've got obviously the Beltway precincts, but it goes all the way out towards Winchester and more rural areas of the state. And so Barbara has always done an excellent job representing all her constituents. And I think that's why, at the end of the day, she's going to prevail in November. She outran, the president in the district before. She, I think, did better than Hillary Clinton did. So I think Barbara is recognized as an independent voice who stands for her constituents, and that's going to benefit her extremely well on election day.
But then we have Corey Stewart, who we discussed earlier, who has described himself as Trump before Trump. This week, he held a rally outside offices in Fairfax County, expressing support for the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the ICE agency. He has falsely claimed that Senator Kaine wants to abolish ICE. But why do you think immigration has become such a hot issue in this campaign?
Well, immigration has been a hot issue for decades. We clearly have an immigration problem in the United States, and it's affecting the Commonwealth of Virginia as well. And Corey Stewart, as a local government chairman, has been on the forefront of fighting illegal immigration and doing what can be done to solve some of the ravages caused by illegal immigration. And so the president ran on that issue, and Corey Stewart has run on it as well. And it's something that needs to be addressed. We go back to, again, the 10th Congressional District, and you've got, Wexton, who opposes even bills related to sanctuary cities and almost does everything she can to oppose efforts to deal with illegal immigration. But Corey Stewart has been a strong proponent of solving and addressing illegal immigration, and I don't see him stopping. And I think that will benefit him on Election Day as well.
Here's Sinclair in Washington on the issue, so to speak, of Corey Stewart. Sinclair, your turn.
Yes. Hello.
Go right ahead, Sinclair. You're on the air.
Yeah, a couple of questions. I hear from this, director of Republican Affairs for the party in Virginia.
It's Mr. Wilson's the chairman of the Republican Party of Virginia, who was elected in September.
From the chairman of the Republican Party of Virginia, what sounds an awful lot like a big embrace of Corey Stewart, who is very well known, it's very well documented, and he doesn't hide it, to have strong leanings and support for Nazi, neo-Nazi, and white supremacist groups.
No, when you say he doesn't hide it, when you say he doesn't hide it, yes, there have been those associations made. Yes, there have been some of those associations documented. But Corey Stewart has said explicitly that he is not in support of those groups or organizations.
And dismissed a staffer or two.
He has said it. He said it as far back as his decision to run. Before that, you can see videos on YouTube of him cheering on white supremacist, neo-Nazi, and Nazi groups. So he can say whatever he likes.
Question?
Just like Trump can say the biggest crowds were...
What's your question, Sinclair?
My question is, how is it that the Republican Party now feels comfortable embracing a person with such an ugly...
Well, Jack Wilson, you haven't have members of Virginia's congressional delegation. Representative Scott Taylor said that there's, quote, no way in hell of Stewart winning the election. He, quoting here, doesn't give an expletive deleted about Corey Stewart. Yeah.
Well, and again, that was a quote from earlier in the summer, too, I believe. But again, Corey Stewart is, and I categorically reject the notion that Corey Stewart is a racist. Corey Stewart has rejected neo-Nazis. He has rejected white nationalists. He is running on an economic platform and running to support the president's economic plans. And Corey Stewart has a track record as chairman of his board in Prince William of working on taxes, working on economic development, working to solve illegal immigration, well, reaching across
the
aisle.
What you seem to be suggesting is that the Republican Party of Virginia has now forgot all of its divisions and come together in support of Corey Stewart?
Well, I think the party is unifying. And again, I go back to almost have to thank the National Democrats in the Senate and the appearance of partisanship and bitterness that they displayed in those Justice Kavanaugh hearings. I think that really woke up a lot of Virginia Republicans and said, you know, Tim Kaine came out against Judge Kavanaugh very early in the process and didn't give him a fair shake. And I think Virginia Republicans recognize now that Tim Kaine has to go. And Corey Stewart is the vehicle to make that happen. And so while there might have been more divisions in the party in August over Corey Stewart, a lot of those divisions are being eliminated because of what the Senate Democrats did to Judge Kavanaugh.
As the chairman of the state party, I appreciate your putting the best face that you see on this, and I really do. I want to move along past November the 6th, as I started out asking you, because you took over the party just in September. You've been a long-term, I think, 4th district party leader.
Right.
You have to look at the Democrats are still dizzy with excitement over their success in 2017. For people who don't follow Virginia politics, they have off-year elections. And next year, 2019, all 140 seats of the General Assembly, the 40 senators and the 100 state delegates, will be up. And it's a near 50-50 split in both houses. How important is it to you that you get the party truly unified going forward to turn back what Democrats say may be a historic election next year, where they will take over the state legislature for the first time in quite a while?
Well, when I was calling members of our state central committee seeking support to run for chairman, that's exactly what my focus was. I said, whoever the next chairman of the Republican Party of Virginia will be will take office as I did in September. A lot of the plans for this November's midterms will be in place. It'll be executing it. And the real focus then would shift immediately to next year's General Assembly races, where it is so critical to the Commonwealth of Virginia that Republicans maintain both houses. Losing both of those houses would set the Commonwealth back easily a decade or more before the Republicans could try to undo the damage that a liberal Democrat governor coupled with two bodies that are ready to rubber stamp his ideas could do to the Commonwealth. So that's where I've already started looking ahead. Clearly, my eyes are on November's midterms, but I've also started looking ahead. What can we do to make sure we pull together after this November and be ready to hit the ground running early 2019 to make sure that some of those seats in the General Assembly that switched to the Democrats last year aren't really Democrat seats. And I'm optimistic we're going to pick some of those back up.
Well, we only have about a minute and a half left. But last week, Virginia House Speaker Kirk Cox, a Republican, canceled the legislative session that was set for later this month to finalize a redistricting plan to remedy racial gerrymandering in the House district lines. This after Democratic Governor Ralph Northam said he would veto the plan Republicans worked out. What kind of process do you want to see to draw Virginia's new lines?
Well, it should have been done what the Constitution requires, which is through the legislature. But I think Speaker Cox recognized before they even meet, the governor said, I'm going to veto any plan that comes out of the General Assembly. There's no sense meeting and spending taxpayer money on a session, I would encourage the governor to go back and recognize that this was the original plan he voted for. The original plan that is being challenged was approved through, you know, President Obama's Justice Department under the Voting Rights Act. And almost every, if not every, African American in the Virginia General Assembly voted for that plan. So the legislative process is the way it should be handled, but the governor clearly thinks he'll get a better deal for the Democrats if he throws it over to the judicial branch and lets the judges draw a map, because the history in Virginia is if the judges draw maps, it's better for the Democrats. So clearly that's what the governor's looking for.
Very quickly, this is not a political question as much, but the Hurricane Michael came through southern Virginia. People have died. Their families have been troubled. What are you hearing in terms of the state response to south of you there in Chesterfield County?
From what I can tell, it sounds like it's going well. Clearly, there have been a lot of flash floods out in the Roanoke area. In my area of Chesterfield, we had some heavy winds and rains and trees down. Schools were closed today. But it seems like the response has been very good. And clearly, we all pray for those families that are in harm's way.
And all the time we have. Jack Wilson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you
Jack
for having
Wilson's
me.
Chair of the Virginia Republican Party. That's it for the show today. But if you'd like to meet us, that is the producers and yours truly in person, and share your feelings on everything from the Caps' first season of Stanley Cup champions to the local noise ordinance that seems to be targeting street musicians, we'll be at Gallery Place at the steps of the National Portrait Gallery today from 4 to 6 p.m. Come share your views on local issues with me today. Again, from 4 to 6 p.m. on the steps of the National Gallery. More information at kojoshow.org. Monday, we'll do a deep dive into how the opioid crisis is affecting our region. Until then, thank you all for listening. Tom Sherwood, have a great weekend.
You too.
I'm Kojo Namdi.